many people get understandings of bits and pieces of the Reformation. They know some of the individuals, they know some of what happened, but not necessarily the whole drama of the Reformation, understanding it chronologically in its geostrategic context, what was going on politically, what was going on in terms of the battles, what was going on in terms of the politics, and who was the leading, and where did they all fit in. So many people have got the idea that John Calvin was very old and Martin Luther was very young, and meanwhile it was actually the other way around. Martin Luther is 25 years the senior of John Calvin, and John Calvin was a second generation reformer. Many don't necessarily get the chronological or geostrategic picture. So what I'm going to attempt to do is, in just under an hour, give the drama of the Reformation, the full picture of what happened, when it happened, who it happened to. But in doing this, it means one's got to be necessarily quite brief, and I'm going to try to do justice to it in the sweep of a century. Shortly after Martin Luther was born, the last Muslim stronghold in Spain, Granada, fell, and the liberation of the Iberian Peninsula was complete. They had suffered for 800 years under Islam. Now they were free. Then Christopher Columbus, that same year, 1492, was able to set sail west across the Atlantic Ocean. He discovered the Americas, the New World. And while southwestern Europe was celebrating its freedom after 8 centuries of oppression and occupation under Islam, southeastern Europe was facing a relentless onslaught of invasion by the Turks. Since the fall of the greatest city in the world at that time, Constantinople, to the Turks in 1453, the massacre of all the Christians in that city, the Turks had been an ever-present threat to Christendom, as Europe at that stage was known. Europe was not called Europe, it was called Christendom at that time. Threatened from the east by relentless Islamic jihad, Europe was suffering from the internal corruption of the Renaissance. The Renaissance was initially a good idea, but it became a time of material advance and spiritual decline. And it led to the rise of absolutism and the loss of individual rights and the loss of representative governments, which Christian principles had developed throughout the Middle Ages. Because as they turned to Rome, they thought the Roman principles were good. So Renaissance rulers were inspired by the prince, by Machiavelli, who rationalized despotism. Machiavelli advised rulers to be careful to maintain public relations through patronage of the arts and conspicuous charities in order to create popularity and to mask the hold on power. And so he recognized what was going on in real politics. Although ancient Rome had practiced human sacrifices, slavery, infanticide, they persecuted Christians, they fed martyrs to wild beasts, but the Renaissance scholars began to hail the pagans as wiser and their times as superior to that of the Christians. And so this Renaissance trend to turn towards the graves of Rome and the graves of Greece, it wasn't progress, it was a regression. It was a return to pagan past, and it was actually a rejection of their Christian faith. So while the Renaissance Italians were reviving pagan writings and the customs of ancient Greece and Rome and unearthing their statues, their paintings and their plays, immorality flourished. Degeneracy accelerated. Along with the physical and intellectual exhumations, the ancient intellectual and spiritual diseases that had led both Rome and Greece to self-destruct came to infect the life in Europe. Literature became shallow, it became imitative, just copying one another. Absurd ancient theories about humours were resuscitated at the expense of medical research, and everyone's municipal freedoms and individual rights were lost, as humanists extolled tyrannical Roman laws, which tyrants were quick to adopt. The idea of a Caesar, an emperor, which was almost a god, that they were to worship, and they thought this is a good idea, that became their model for leadership. The impact of glorifying a licentious past was absolutely devastating to the morals and the behavior of Southern Europe. The despairing conclusion of Renaissance humanism was that life is meaningless. So to escape this intellectual cul-de-sac where they got to this dead-end street, many began to plunge into the blind fortune of astrology and magic. Look to the stars. People had lost their belief in sin, and in rejecting the very idea of eternal life, they desperately sought for earthly fame and fortune, because this is all the life you're going to get. Paganism deepened as the Renaissance extended. From the 14th to the 16th century, many of the cities in southern Europe appointed official stargazers, astrologers. Universities had official stargazers. Even the popes relied on horoscopes. With almost any position in the Catholic Church open to the highest bidder, church positions became dominated by corrupt, money-grabbing humanists who ruthlessly persecuted the genuine believers. Martin Luther, a brilliant lawyer and a theologian, visited Rome in 1510, and Luther was shocked at the corruption and the degeneracy in Rome. Everything is permitted in Rome except to be an honest man. To finance the Pope's extravagant living and the construction of St. Peter's Cathedral, the Catholic Church was selling dispensations that allowed purchasers to break the church rules, to eat meat on fast days, to marry a close relative, to commit adultery, and so on. Dispensations were being sold. And in addition, the Catholic Church was selling indulgences, which could only be cashed in heaven, to which they claimed to hold the keys. They have the keys of St. Peter. And these heavenly credits could be balanced against one's sins that one committed on earth. Now, these earthly and spiritual pardons were being sold by a Dominican monk, Johann Tetzel, in Saxony, when Dr. Martin Luther, now professor of Wittenberg University, wrote the 95 Theses in protest. Luther argued that only God could forgive sins, and it's better to help the poor than to buy indulgences. Truly repentant people do not desire to avoid punishment, rather they are seeking punishment, because they're repentant. Luther's challenge was in Latin, but some enterprising printers translated it into German and began to print and sell copies of it. And soon, the 95 Theses were available in French and Spanish and Flemish, Dutch, Italian. Soon, Luther's dramatic challenge against the unbiblical corruptions of indulgences was being read in the marketplaces and the palaces of Europe. Even the Pope was handed a copy to read. Between 1570 and 1520, 300,000 copies of Luther's writings were sold throughout Europe. It was the first time in history that a revolutionary idea had impacted a continent through a mass medium. In this way, Martin Luther can be called the world's first journalist. Translators, printers, journalists, itinerant salesmen all worked together to challenge the entire social and ecclesiastical system of the Catholic Church and the Holy Roman Empire. So at about the same time as Cortes was entering Mexico and encountering Montezuma and his bloodthirsty Aztec Empire, Luther was challenging the Holy Roman Empire in Europe. He taught that faith alone, not good works, makes a man righteous. Good works flow and follow from faith. The tree bears fruit, the fruit does not bear the tree. Luther taught that we could not only receive forgiveness for our sins, but victory over the power of sin, over our carnal nature, by God's grace alone. Not just salvation in sin, but salvation from sin. Not only saved from the guilt of sin, but from the power of sin. By the end of 1520, Luther was proclaimed the Pope Antichrist. Excommunicated by the Pope, all that stood between Luther and death at the hands of the Emperor was the protection of the Elector of Saxony, Prince Frederick the Wise, who is reported to have said, "There's much in the Bible about Christ, but not much about Rome." Prince Frederick of Saxony is one of the most senior and influential electors in Germany. He had been a serious contender for the position of Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Charles V was Emperor of Germany, King of Spain, Sardinia, Sicily, the Netherlands. His ships sailed around the globe. His armies dominated all of Europe. However, Charles V could not ignore the authority of Prince Frederick because Germany was still largely feudal, decentralized. The Emperor's power was not absolute. The German people still enjoyed many of the rights and powers which the Renaissance had swept away elsewhere, where things were more centralized, such as in Italy and France. But Germany still had power decentralized down to the local princes and municipalities. Only recently crowned emperor, and just 21 years old, Charles V had to be seen to respect the authority of the elector. After all, these six electors had just crowned him, and Prince Frederick was one of the most senior of them. So Prince Frederick extracted a guarantee of safe conduct for Luther from the emperor. Summoned to Worms on the 18th of April 1521, Martin Luther stood firm before the emperor, six princes, 24 dukes, 30 archbishops and bishops, 7 ambassadors, gathered for one purpose, to intimidate Martin Luther to back down. The young emperor sat on a raised dais, surrounded by men in gleaming armor. by mitred archbishops and splendidly dressed nobles. Luther was denied any opportunity to debate or defend his doctrines. He was asked two questions. First, confirm that the publications on the table were his. Second, whether he would recant. Admit that his writings were all heretical and reject them. Confirming that the books and the booklets and the leaflets were his writings, Martin Luther pointed out they were of different types, including basic Christian doctrine, which were accepted Christian truths. He could not recant scriptural truth. Others of his works exposed the corrupt, living, scandalous abuses and evils of the popes. If he were to reject these writings, he would be like a cloak that covers evil. Now, at this point, the emperor leaned forward and shouted, "No!" That's about the only word he said publicly at that meeting. Luther continued that other of his works were against private individuals who had attacked his work and attempted to defend popery. He confessed that in these he had written too harshly. The court demanded that Luther recant all his writings. Pressed again in Latin if he would recant, Luther answered in German so that everyone present could understand. "Unless I am convinced by scripture or by clear reasoning that I am in error, for popes and councils have often erred and contradicted themselves, I cannot recant, for I am subject by the scriptures I have quoted. My conscience is captive to the word of God. It is unsafe and dangerous to do anything against one's conscience. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise, so help me God. Amen." Luther's courageous and historic speech before the assembled might and authority of the Holy Roman Empire and the Catholic Church shook the world. He laid the foundations for free representative government, freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, freedom of association, constitutionalism, lex rex, the idea that the law is king, separation of powers. All these great principles flowed out of the stand that Martin Luther was making. Charles V was furious. He wanted Martin Luther burned as a heretic. But Prince Frederick insisted that he honor his guarantee of a safe conduct. Luther was allowed to leave, but the emperor and four electors signed a statement declaring Luther an outlaw. Prince Frederick of Saxony and the elector of the Palatinate refused to sign, very courageously. So while frantic efforts were being made to arrest Luther, Prince Frederick secretly arranged for his kidnapping and his spiriting away to be hidden as Junker York, or Knight George, in the Wartburg Castle. There in disguise, in seclusion, Luther began a Bible translation blitzkrieg, and by the end of 1522, the German New Testament was on sale for only a week's wages. Back in Wittenberg, Luther's colleagues Philip Melanchthon, 21-year-old professor of Greek, and Andreas Bolstein Karlstadt, a 30-year-old professor of philosophy and theology, continued the work of Reformation in Luther's absence. But Karlstadt took Luther's intellectual rebellion and turned it into a religious revolution. He whipped up the crowd to destroy statues and shrines and religious artifacts as idols that needed to be destroyed. When Luther heard of this, he was shocked. He taught the people not to take the law into their own hands. Everything should be done decently and in order. Eliminating idolatry in the hearts comes before eradicating idols and images in the church. Images were a central means of communicating basic Christian truth in the Middle Ages. As very few of the population could read and write, Bible stories were depicted through stained glass windows, through statues and pictures. During the Middle Ages, it began to be accepted that Christians would not only learn the faith through these visual representations, but they'd start to express their faith through reverencing these images. So an entire devotional system was developed. An industry involving carpenters and painters and goldsmiths and silversmiths and other artisans built their livelihoods around providing images for the church. So the Reformation, with its rejection of such idolatry, posed an economic threat to many of these people. Martin Luther was far and away the most popular author in Europe. At one point, something like 80% of all the printed works in the whole world were Martin Luther's writings. His writings outsold all others in Spain and France and Italy and Netherlands and Switzerland and Germany and England. And he made use of woodcuts too to make it even more accessible and visually appealing to the masses. Priests and nuns poured out of the church and rushed towards marriage. Princes were converted to the Reformation. The new Pope, Adrian VI, elected in 1521, upon the death of King Leo of Louis the Tenth, the Pope, who had excommunicated Luther and not lived very long after that, he demanded Luther's arrest, but the Prince of Saxony refused to cooperate. Radical opportunists like Thomas Münzer used this intellectual and spiritual upheaval to try and launch a political revolution. By the end of 1524, 30,000 armed peasants had risen up and began looting castles, monasteries, pillaging churches, kidnapping nobles, demanding ransoms, and committing widespread arson and mass murder. Luther was horrified, and he issued a pamphlet in 1524 against the robbing and murdering hordes of peasants. He not only dissociated from these bandits and revolutionaries, but he applied biblical principles as to the duty of the princes to use the sword to protect the law-abiding and to punish the lawbreakers. The princes responded decisively against this anarchy and this lawlessness. Münzer and 5,000 of his revolutionaries were wiped out by the knights. Another 20,000 rebellious peasants were killed in Alaska. But the greatest loss of life during this peasants' rebellion occurred in Austria. Charles V's younger brother Ferdinand crushed the rebellion with 130,000 peasants killed in battle or by execution. The peasant revolt had been absolutely disastrous. Hundreds of castles and monasteries had been ruined. Hundreds of towns were depopulated and impoverished. And I might add that Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels count these Anabaptists who started this as the world's first communists. Over 50,000 homeless wandered across the countryside or hid in the forest. There were many widows and orphans. And because the rebels had destroyed the charters that recorded the municipal rights and feudal dues, new charters, far more demanding, were drawn up. And censorship laws for the first time were being enforced all over Europe. Then in 1526, the Muslim Turks attacked Hungary. Suleiman the Magnificent overwhelmed the small Hungarian army of 30,000 with his 300,000 invading Turks. King Louis II of Hungary was killed. The capital Buda of what today is Budapest was captured, looted by the Turks, and the Turkish invaders carried off over 200,000 Hungarian Christians into Islamic slavery. I mean, that's almost from the heart of Europe, Budapest. The next year, 1527, Emperor Charles V led his army to capture Rome, the richest city in Europe. The corruption and the meddling of the Pope had outraged even this ardent Catholic, Charles V. Now his army sacked Rome itself. The Pope was held for an immense ransom. Throughout Europe, this was seen as the judgment of God upon a debauched city and a corrupt church. Very interesting that Charles V himself, the defender of the Pope, would be the one who actually exacted judgment on them. The Catholic Inquisition in the Netherlands demanded that all hold to and believe the doctrines of the Roman Catholic Church. Men and women who disobey this command shall be punished as disturbers of the public order. Women who have fallen into heresy shall be burned alive. Men, if they recant, shall lose their heads. If they continue obstinate, they shall be burned at the stake. The Inquisition is to inquire into the private opinions of every person, of whatever degree. Law officers of all kinds shall assist the Inquisition at their peril. Those who know where heretics are concealed shall denounce them, or they shall suffer as heretics themselves. Under this edict in the Netherlands, over 50,000 Protestants were killed. In Switzerland, Ulrich Zwingli had launched a parallel reformation, starting with the expository preaching of the Gospel of Matthew on the 1st of January, 1519, in Grossmünster, in Zurich. The city council supported Zwingli's reforms, and all Zurich clergymen were ordered to preach only from the Bible. The Bible became the basis for all law. The council abolished the Mass. All religious images and statues, relics, ornaments were removed from the churches. Monks and nuns and priests were permitted to marry, and soon other Swiss cantons were embracing the Reformation. In 1529, a Protestant missionary from Zurich was burned at the stake for preaching the gospel in the Catholic canton of Schweiz. Zurich stopped all trade with Schweiz in protest, and the Catholic cantons declared war. At the Battle of Kappel in October 1531, 8,000 Catholic soldiers overwhelmed the 1,500 Protestant soldiers at the Battle of Kappel. Zurich reformer Ulrich Zwingli was wounded in this battle and killed by a Catholic captain when he refused to call upon the Virgin Mary. At the beginning of the 16th century, France was the largest and richest nation in Europe. France had a population of 16 million at a time when Spain had 7 million and England had only 3 million. Paris was the largest city in Europe with a population of 300,000. Luther's books poured into France. French reformer Jacques Lafer published a French translation of the New Testament in 1523 and the next year of the Psalms. And for this he is denounced as a heretic. King Francis I ordered vigorous persecution to stamp out the Protestant faith in his realm. Protestants were branded, their hands and noses were amputated, red-hot irons were applied to the head, many were burned alive. At the same time that King Francis I was ordering the mutilations and tortures of Protestants, his sister, Marguerite, was herself praying with the reformer Farel and protecting Protestants. So this was dividing families. Brilliant young law student John Calvin was converted to the Protestant faith and started to call for a purified Christianity, stressing salvation through grace. He wrote a treatise on life after death and another on Christian doctrine. Calvin was arrested twice, and after a number of life-threatening escapes, he was declared an outlaw and is on the run from the authorities. By 1536, he had produced the Institutes of the Christian Religion, a theological masterpiece, systematically expounding the biblical faith, the conduct and the devotion of the Protestant faith. When the French Protestant preacher Guillemin Farel first came to Geneva, it was a very immoral city. Geneva had a prostitute quarter, priests living with concubines, a corrupt bishop. Farel first came to Geneva in October 1532. Farel was a missionary from Bern, the strongest Protestant canton in Switzerland, and they had sponsored him as a missionary to win other cities to Christ. Farel had played a leading role in bringing about the triumph of the Reformation in Bern, in Neuchâtel, and several other towns. He had also won over the Waldenses to embrace the principles of the Reformation. Farel's fiery preaching and unbeatable logic in debate with the Catholics won the city. He would challenge him to debate and he would win. And as hundreds of Genevans were won to Christ, Farel seized the Cathedral of St. Peter's. And on 21st May 1536, the General Assembly of Citizens voted in favour of the Reformation and made the Protestant faith the official religion of Geneva. With Genevan revolt against its bishop and against the Duke of Savoy, Farel knew that his eloquence and evangelistic zeal was not sufficient to disciple this very distracted city. It was at this opportune time that a local war compelled Calvin to divert through Geneva. He is on his way to Strasbourg, but a war forced him to divert through Geneva, and he planned to only spend one night there. When Farel heard that this famous French scholar and author was passing through, he hurried to recruit him. Calvin's mind was set on his studies. He wanted to be a professional student for his whole life. But Farel would have none of that. He threatened that God would curse his studies if he refused to aid the church in Geneva at this critical time. Visibly shaken, struck with terror, Calvin reluctantly agreed to serve in Geneva. And John Calvin began his ministry in the Church of St. Peter's by preaching through the Epistle of St. Paul. King Francis I of France shocked all of Christendom by making an alliance with the Turks in his war against Charles V. His political and military gamble failed. He was defeated, he died bankrupt and in disgrace in 1547. The deaths of both Francis I of England, Francis I of France and Henry VIII of England in the same year, 1547, emphasized the turbulence of that time, when Luther and Zwingli and Farel and Tyndale were contending with the popes and with Charles V. Henry VIII and Francis I, they were contending for the heart, the mind and the soul of Christendom. The Protestant faith had swept across Europe. It was flourishing in Switzerland, Germany, Holland, England and Scotland. In Scotland, the reformer George Vysart was burned at the stake. The archbishop responsible for his execution, Cardinal David Beaton, was brutally assassinated in revenge. And then a group of ardent Protestants, the Castilians, took over the city of St. Andrews and garrisoned themselves in the castle there. And they were joined by John Knox, who was the chaplain. They were besieged by a French fleet, captured and condemned to the galleys. When King Henry VIII of England died, his 9-year-old son, a dedicated Protestant, Edward VI, became king. Archbishop Thomas Cranmer, now instituted sweeping reforms. All paintings and images were removed from churches. The Mass was abolished, replaced with communion. The English language replaced Latin in worship services. The English Book of Common Prayer was introduced, reforming the worship. Priests received permission to marry. Stone altars were demolished and replaced by communion tables. Protestant books and pamphlets flooded England. You can see here people gathering around to hear the person who can read, reading the scripture that's chained to the lectern. And this is in the vestibule of the church where people could come and hear the scripture being read by lay readers. Guided by John Calvin's biblical preaching and a systematic teaching, Geneva became the hub of the Reformation. Refugees fleeing persecution found sanctuary in Geneva. Calvin's writings produced the greatest concentration of princes and publishing firms in the world. And he established the academy which taught Greek and Hebrew and Latin and theology. And graduates of Calvin's academy carried the Reformed teachings into France and Holland, England and Scotland. King Edward VI of England intervened to secure the release of Protestants of St. Andrews, including John Knox, from the galley of France in a prison exchange. Knox was now appointed royal chaplain and helped Archbishop Cranmer producing the Book of Common Prayer. Then the young Protestant King Edward became seriously ill, and rumours that he'd been poisoned by a Catholic assassin abounded. And he almost certainly was. He died before he even reached age 16. Fears for the future of the Reformation in England at the imminent death of King Edward VI caused the regent, the Duke of Northumberland, to persuade the king to alter the laws of succession, to bypass his Catholic sister Mary and crown Lady Jane Grey, his cousin, as queen. In the end, Edward's death came swiftly, and as the Catholic forces mustered to take Mary and place Mary Tudor on the throne of England, Jane, the queen, for only 9 days. She was arrested and imprisoned in the Tower of London, and she is pressured by her cousin Mary to renounce her Protestant faith and embrace Catholicism. But this very brave 16-year-old Lady Jane courageously remained steadfast and was beheaded as a result. And there are several pages dedicated to her. I think 4 pages in Fox's Book of Martyrs of Lady Jane Grey's courageous responding to the Inquisition, her steadfastness of faith and knowledge. She knew the scriptures, she outwitted them, but she lost her head as a result of her steadfast Protestant faith. Queen Mary married the heir to the Holy Roman Empire, Prince Philip of Spain, the son of Charles V. Philip arrived with a huge fleet of ships and a vast Spanish entourage to dominate the English court. Cardinal Reginald Pole was appointed Archbishop of Canterbury, and England was formally returned to Catholicism. The most prominent Protestant bishops, including Hooper and Ridley and Latimer, and the previous Archbishop Cranmer, were burned at the stake, followed by hundreds of other prominent Protestant leaders. But with every execution, resistance to Catholicism spread and commitment to the Reformation doctrines deepened. As Charles V abdicated in 1556, Mary's husband Philip became King Philip II. Soon English troops and the cavalry were being sent to the Netherlands to help crush the widespread Protestant revolt. From the perspective of the Holy Roman Empire, the year 1558 was disastrous. Charles V, the emperor whom Martin Luther had defied with his conscience, is captive to the word of God's speech. He died in agony. So Charles V dies on the 21st of September 1558. Charles V had, by his own estimation, condemned over 30,000 Protestants to torturous executions during his reign. He said to his daughter-in-law, Bloody Mary, "I've sent 30,000 Protestants to the stake. It wasn't enough. My greatest regret is not burning Martin Luther when I had him in Worms. You must burn more people at the stake than that if you're going to keep England from the Protestants." Now, how's that for fatherly advice? Shortly after that, on the 17th of November 1558, Bloody Mary died of fever. 12 hours later, her Cardinal Pole, Archbishop Canterbury, died of the same fever in Lambeth Palace. 1559 began with the Protestants on the march and with the Catholic cause in defeat and retreat. Emperor Charles V was now dead. His sister Mary, the former regent of the Netherlands, also died. Mary of Lorraine, regent of Scotland, also out of power and on the run. Bloody Mary's counter-reformation in England had been counterproductive. Instead of returning England to Catholicism, she had only succeeded in entrenching the vast majority of Englishmen in their commitment to the Reformation. On the 15th of January 1559, Protestant Elizabeth Tudor was crowned Queen of England. On the 2nd of May 1559, John Knox returns from exile to Scotland, and his fiery sermons against idolatry galvanized the Scottish into immediate action. Altars were demolished. Images, statues, crucifixes were removed from the churches. The Scottish lords of the congregation worked together with the English to force all French troops to leave Scottish soil. The Scottish Parliament instructed John Knox to draw up a confession of faith, which was adopted into law. In 1560, the Geneva Bible was published. And before it was replaced by the King James Version, over 140 editions of the Geneva Bible had been published, which was far and away the most popular English Bible of the Reformation. The attempt to return Scotland to Catholicism by the return of Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots, in 1561, put the Reformation in jeopardy. Mary Stuart was heir to England's throne if Elizabeth died. Numerous Catholic assassination attempts and intrigues to replace Elizabeth I with Mary, Queen of Scots, underlined the peril to the cause of the Reformation and the peril to freedom in England itself. Mary, Queen of Scots' immorality and her intrigues outraged the population of Scotland. Her outrages led John Knox to courageously confront Mary and the scandal caused by complicity in the murder of her husband and the marrying of his murderer. And this finally led to her being forced to abdicate in 1567. Her infant son was then crowned King James VI of Scotland, and he later became James I of England. And Knox preached at James VI's coronation, which took from Josiah's coronation while his grandmother screamed murder from the balcony and was thrown over to her death. And that was his application, you can imagine. Choice of text. Meanwhile, while the Reformation was triumphing in Britain, it was under relentless attack on the continent of Europe. Charles V's son, Philip II, was determined to crush the flourishing Protestant faith in Holland. In 1566, Philip issued a proclamation requiring all of his subjects to accept the decrees made by the Council of Trent, the Council of Reformation. All who would not comply with these demands were to be delivered to the inquisitors. In 1567, Philip sent in his Spanish troops led by the cruel Duke of Alva. Alva set up the Council of Blood, which had 8,000 Dutch Protestants executed. Another 30,000 had their property confiscated. In 1568, the Inquisition condemned the entire population of the Netherlands, 3 million men, women, and children, to death as heretics. That's got to be the most extreme overreaction in the history of the world. At this point, William the Silent, Prince of Orange, became the leader of the persecuted Dutch Protestants. William and his Dutch soldiers fought valiantly despite overwhelming odds. Their greatest strength was in their skilled navy, which, although they were vastly outnumbered and outgunned by the Spanish, they triumphed over the Spanish time and again. In 1579, the seven northern provinces joined to form the United Provinces of the Netherlands. In 1581, the United Provinces declared the Netherlands to be totally independent of Spain. In 1584, the Dutch suffered a severe blow when a Spanish agent assassinated Prince William, the father of Dutch liberties. The Dutch Protestants continued to fight for their freedom until 1648, when they finally achieved independence from Spain. And that's just 4 years before Jan van Riebeek was sent to the Cape to establish South Africa. It was not as though Europe's only threat was from the treacherous tyrants. Just before the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in France, Europe faced the most desperate attack from the Muslim Turks. In 1571, the Turkish Empire stretched from the Ukraine to Hungary, to Egypt and Persia, from North Africa to the Caspian Sea. Turkish warships were attacking Christian shipping all across North Africa. Turkish pirates were pillaging and looting the coasts of Europe, capturing Christians as slaves as far afield as England and Iceland. And it's at this time that the great siege of Malta took place. 1565, Islam was threatening all of Europe. The Ottoman Turkish Empire had conquered the entire Middle East, sacking the greatest city of the world at that time, Constantinople, massacring the entire Christian population there. In 1526, the Turks had unsuccessfully besieged Vienna in the very heart of Europe. Muslim slave raiders were depopulating whole villages, attacking coastal towns of Italy, France, Spain, Portugal, England, Wales, and Ireland, even seizing white slaves from as far away as Iceland. Ultimately, over 1.1 million Christian Europeans were kidnapped and enslaved by Muslim pirates between 1500 and 1800. But one thorn in the side of the aggressive expansionism of the Ottoman Empire was the Christian island of Malta. Malta was the headquarters of the last Crusaders, the Knights Hospitaller, the Order of St. John of Jerusalem. In 1571, Cyprus fell to the Turks, 5,000 Greek and Italian Christians killed, 30,000 Turkish attackers in a fierce resistance. Only after all supplies were exhausted and guarantees of safe conduct were offered did the garrison finally surrender. But the Turks absolutely treacherously had all the Venetian prisoners executed, the rest of the Christian shipped to Constantinople as slaves. The courageous Christian general Bragadino had his nose and his ears cut off, his teeth broken, whipped daily until 17 August when he was flayed alive in a city square. The Turks laid waste to the island of Corfu, massed their fleets to attack Europe. The European forces were led by Don John of Austria, half-brother Philip II. The Battle of Lepanto on the 7th of October 1571 was one of the most critical naval battles in history. The Christian forces with only 208 warships were outnumbered by the larger Turkish fleet of 230. But the Christian forces closed in for the fight in hand-to-hand combat with the enemy. Spanish infantry flowed onto the Turkish vessels in ferocious hand-to-hand combat to overwhelm the Turks. The Turkish losses were estimated at over 30,000 dead and wounded, 15,000 prisoners. On their side, the Christians lost 10 galleys, 8,000 men killed, 21,000 wounded. Lepanto was one of the great turning points in history. It ended the fear of the Turks that had threatened to overwhelm all of Europe. It stopped the Turkish advance. Church bells were tolling throughout Europe as many prayers of thanksgiving were offered by millions of grateful Europeans. Otto Scott observed, "Only God could have saved so divided a Europe against so determined and savage, rich and heavily armed a foe." After Lepanto, the Turk remained a menace, but not an unconquerable one. But then the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre horrified Protestants worldwide and entrenched the conviction that the Catholic Church was treacherous and that its guarantees and treaties would not be honored. Up to 30,000 Protestants were massacred throughout France, including the leader of the French Huguenots, Admiral Gaspard de Coligny. The massacre was ordered by King Charles IX under the influence of his wicked Jezebel of a mother, Catherine de Medici. And it included the leader of the French Huguenots, Admiral Gaspard de Coligny, who was a most honorable man. And this massacre was ordered by King Charles IX under the influence of his wicked witch of a mother, Catherine de Medici. The St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre began on 24th of August 1572 at 3 in the morning. The first to be murdered was the aristocratic Admiral Coligny. Henry of Guise supervised the attack. His men burst into Coligny's room, stabbed him, threw the admiral out of the window. As Coligny landed at Guise's feet, Henry of Guise spat at the body and told his men to spread the word that the king had ordered the death of all Huguenots. "Kill them all. Kill them all," he said. Horrible slaughter and mutilations followed, and approximately 5,000 Protestants were murdered in Paris alone. The Spanish ambassador wrote, "As I write, they're killing them all. They're stripping them naked, sparing not even the children. Blessed be God." Can you imagine writing something like that? Similar massacres occurred in Lyon, Gien, Tours, Rouen, Troyes, Toulouse. A total of 30,000 Protestants murdered on St. Bartholomew's Day throughout France. When the news reached Rome, the Cardinal of Lorraine gave the bearer of the news 1,000 crowns. He's so excited to hear this. Pope Gregory XIII and his cardinals attend a solemn high mass of thanksgiving for the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre. The Pope ordered a special medal struck commemorating the massacre with the words, "The Pope approves of the killing of Coligny." The St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre permanently altered Protestant thinking. Calvinists turned from their previous accepting of the divine right of kings to questioning the entire institution of the monarchy. Here's the Spanish ambassador being summoned before Queen Elizabeth in England, where the entire court was dressed in black and mourning to be to be berated by the Queen for the treachery of their King. The Catholic cause, already stained by Bloody Mary's persecutions in England and the Duke of Alva's slaughter in the Netherlands, was now indelibly identified with the most bestial persecutions, tyranny and treachery. This is a sketching of the English embassy in Paris, where the people have taken some refugees from amongst the Huguenots in for protection. They're looking out the windows at the horrors going on outside their gates. 2 months later, the Calvinists launched an offensive that lasted nearly a year. At its conclusion, Charles IX was forced to sign another treaty guaranteeing freedom of religion in France. English gold and practical support boosted the Protestant resistance in the Netherlands and in Scotland. So Jesuit assassins and conspirators arrived in England to arrange for the overthrow of Elizabeth I and the replacement with Mary Stuart, Mary Queen of Scots. An army bearing papal banners invaded Ireland. In 1583, a Catholic plot involving English noblemen and a Spanish invasion was uncovered. The Spanish ambassador was expelled from England. As long as Mary Stuart remained alive, she presented a clear and present danger to the life of Elizabeth, the survival of the Protestant faith, and freedom in England. Mary Stuart represented Spain, the vast Catholic international, the guises of France, into whose family she was married. Parliament placed Mary Stuart on trial at Fotheringay Castle. Despite attempts by her cousin, Queen Elizabeth, to stop the proceedings, Mary Stuart was sentenced to death and executed 12th of May, 1587. Philip II, who had recently conquered Portugal, now began to prepare for an invasion of England. And this was while France was being torn by civil war with three armies in the field, one led by the giggling transvestite with a whitened face, Henry III, the other by Henry, Duke of Guise, and the third by Henry of Navarre, a Protestant. So you've got the three Henrys fighting for the throne. King Philip of Spain then launched what the Spanish called the Invincible Armada. The world had never before seen such a powerful fleet. And having recently defeated the Turkish fleet, this tiny English navy was not perceived to be any significant obstacle to the Spanish invasion and conquest of England. Spain was a superpower. England was nothing. Philip looked forward to the destruction of the Protestants and the restoration of Catholicism in England. With English support severed, he believed it would be easy to finally crush the rebellion in the Netherlands. However, while churches throughout Europe held extraordinary prayer meetings, a storm wrecked the Spanish plans. The Duke of Parma's invasion barges from Holland were not able to be used. The English tactic of setting fireships amongst the huge Spanish galleons created confusion. Courageous action by English seamen and continuing storms decimated and broke up the Spanish armada. Dutch support also helped the English defeat the Spanish armada. Much of what was left of Philip's fleet was devastated by more storms on the coast of Scotland and Ireland. Only a miserable remnant of the once proud armada limped back into the ports of Spain. 51 Spanish ships and 20,000 Spanish men had been lost, and the English navy hadn't lost a single ship. The greatest superpower of Europe at that time had suffered a crippling blow. The defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588 marked the great watershed of history. It signaled the decline of Spain and the rise of England and Holland. Commemorative medals were struck with inscriptions, "God blew and they were scattered. Man proposes, God disposes." Before 1588, the world powers were Spain and Portugal. These Roman Catholic empires dominated the seas and the overseas possessions of Europe. Only after the English defeated the Spanish Armada did the possibility arise of Protestant missionaries crossing the seas. John Calvin did send a missionary team to Brazil, but they were betrayed by Jesuits and executed within a short while of arriving in Brazil, showing just how unworkable it was to send missionaries overseas when the Catholics controlled overseas colonies and the oceans. As the Dutch and the British grew in military and naval strength, they were able to challenge the Catholic dominance of the seas and the new continents. And so now, foreign missions became a distinct possibility. The defeat of Spain led to the triumph of the Reformation. Had the Armada succeeded, recent history would be unrecognizable. In the 16th century, Spain led the Catholic cause. England led the Protestant cause. All of Europe feared Spain. It had defeated all its adversaries, even the Turk. The Catholic nations of Europe had every expectation that Spain would succeed in crushing Protestantism by conquering England and Holland. But when the Armada failed, the mystique of Spanish invincibility was destroyed. With the defeat of Catholic Spain, the Vatican cause floundered. Bloody Mary had undermined Catholic credibility, and now the defeat of the Spanish Armada eradicated every hope that the Reformation in England could be reversed. The extraordinary energies that had been released by the rediscovery of the Bible in the common language had led to the most extraordinary spiritual revival in history. It had freed the Christians of Northern Europe from the decadence of the Renaissance paganism and led to the greatest birth of freedom and scientific discoveries in history. That is why we must say that the 16th century was the greatest century of Reformation. The first seeds had been sown back in the 1300s and the 14th century by great work done by the Lollards under Professor John Wycliffe of Oxford University. But in the 16th century under Dr. Martin Luther, the Reformation was galvanized into such a flame of freedom and spiritual revival that swept the entire continent. And this presentation I've given is the first chapter in the greatest century of Reformation. And of course we've got these in audio, and many of the victorious Christians covered also in the Heroes of the Faith. And in the audio box, it's, I don't know if you've noticed it, but we now have a new Reformation essay website. The old website's been upgraded, and this is now what it looks like on the homepage, with some of the PowerPoints available as well that you can access. And we're upgrading and updating all the time. There are already 46 PowerPoints on SlideShare available on the web, and many of them have been viewed by thousands of people individually. So these PowerPoints are just another way of reaching a wider range of people worldwide. Any questions? Comments?
How do you access that? Do you just click on the
list? Yes, it just takes a little while to upload. Mm-hmm. But yes, every one of those PowerPoints is now accessible and visible online. Well, not all of ours, but the 46 we've loaded. We've actually got hundreds of PowerPoints. Yes, it'll have the picture and text like what we see here. Mm-hmm. And you can click on the right to get it on full screen. You can have just small screen, but you can move it to big screen, which of course would take a little bit longer to load, but it will. What I often do is I get it to load, go and do something else, come back, and then it just takes a few minutes to fully load. And of course if you click through slowly, reading everything at the time, it'll go fine. If you try and race through, well, it might freeze a bit while it catches up. So normally it's just get it loaded, walk, do something else, make some coffee, come back, and then it'll be fine. Any other comments, questions?
I'm a bit confused about the Spanish situation, because in the beginning the Spanish were killing the Dutch.
Yeah.
And then you spoke about how the Spanish navy defeated the Turks, which saved the Reformation.
Yes.
And then Spain was trying to attack England again with their army.
Just a few years later.
And when you spoke about them attacking the Turks, you spoke about them Christians attacking the Turks.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Of course, when we speak about Christians in general, correctly speaking, has to include Orthodox, Catholic, Protestant, Coptic, I mean, all categories, all who name the name of Christ. Now, we're not suggesting by that they are born again, that they are regenerate, that they have a vibrant relationship with the Lord. We're not saying they're in the Lamb's Book of Life. But from a missionary perspective, or certainly when you're dealing with persecuted church, anyone who calls himself a Christian has to be put under that category of Christian. Now, just like when I say Protestant, I'm talking about everyone who would be a member of a Protestant church. It doesn't mean he's got a right relationship with the Lord. So we've got to distinguish. So when you're fighting the Muslims, and the Muslims see themselves fighting the Christians, they don't distinguish much between whether they're killing Coptic, Orthodox, Catholic, or Protestant. To the Muslims, we are Christians. And so when you've got the Battle of Lepanto, you have German, Austrian, Spanish, Italian Christians all working together to defeat the Muslims. At the Battle of Malta, it wasn't just Catholics. There were Protestants fighting at the Battle of Malta. The Knights of St. John actually includes a Protestant wing. And there were German and English and Scottish volunteers who came to fight as well. They were a minority. I mean, most were Spanish and Italian and French. But there was also a significant contingent of German, Dutch, and English and Scottish Knights of St. John fighting in Malta too. So the Battle of Malta, while it was mostly Catholics, there were the Protestant wing. To this day, the Knights of St. John have their Protestant wing. For example, they gave an honorary knighthood to Mary Celeste of Calabar, who's obviously a Protestant. So on occasions, the Catholics and Protestants would work together because you're fighting a common enemy of the Turks. Now, it's God's sense of humor that he would have used the Spanish, who were generally the enemies of the Reformation, to save Europe from the Turkish menace. And yet he would, once that was done, after Lepanto, and no doubt God helped give that victory, that he would defeat the Spanish when it came to Holland and England, in the case of the Protestant faith. And you can see this in different ways, how God will use the Babylonians and the Syrians even for his purposes. And Cyrus was even there as a pagan king, and yet by God's command he gave the order to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the city. So there are times that God has worked through these elements. Now, if you think of Austria, from one sense, Austria is the great enemy of the Reformation. Austria's armies and kings are the persecutors of the Protestants. But on the other hand, Austria is the great Eastern Empire that protects Europe from the Turks. And for centuries, Austria is the bulwark that protects the whole of the heartland of Europe from Turkish invasion. So, Austria is our enemy, but they're also our ally. The Spanish are our enemy, but they're also our ally. God has used both the Spanish and Austrians to protect Europe against the Turks, but then he also moved against them when they were, of course, persecuting the Protestants. This is part of history.
Yes, and the Spanish also expelled the Muslims. This was also a major achievement. Yeah.
And because they expelled the Muslims from Spain, they could then sponsor Christopher Columbus to start the expedition over to the west, which discovers America. And yet God providentially still kept the Spanish from settling North America. They settled Central and South America, and North America is kept open for the Protestant, English and Dutch to settle later. Similarly with the Cape, although Bartholomew Diaz and Vasco da Gama, Portuguese Catholics, were the first to land on these shores, they didn't settle here. While they settled in Mozambique and Angola because of better climate, they scorned South Africa's coast because it was so stormy and rocky and the climate was so unfavorable and so miserable. So they weren't interested in settling Cape, praise God. So although they had a two-century head start, the Cape and the whole of South Africa is kept open, uninhabited by any European settlers, until the Protestant Dutch have broken free from the Spanish, have built up the navy, and they come and settle. So God providentially kept both North America and South Africa free from Catholic settlement, so that our parts of the world, which are major missionary sending countries, could have been settled by Protestants. And you can see the providential hand of God in many of these things. But yes, there are times when I think of the Austrians and the Spanish as our allies in a common fight against Islam, and other times when they are our mortal enemies because they are sponsoring the Inquisition, persecuting our Protestant brethren. So you've got to recognize the times, and that's why I believe at this precise moment it is foolish for us to fight the Catholics. The Catholics are our allies at this moment, and the Orthodox, in fighting against Catholicism, fighting against Islam, and fighting against secular humanism and communism. And so at this moment there should be a steady truce. We don't give up our distinctives, we don't ignore our history. But Catholics are allies in the pro-life fight, and the fight against evolutionism, and the fight against Islam. This is just a higher priority. The Muslims are a greater threat.
But I think the Reformation has also had an influence on Catholicism, in that Catholics are now allowed to read the Bible.
Yes.
They're not supposed to interpret the Bible, but I mean they have a lot more liberty, and I think there are a lot more evangelical Catholics now than ever before.
Yes, the fact that Roman Catholics are now having the Mass in the common language instead of in Latin. They're having sermons from the scriptures. They've got the Bible available. Things that they would have burned a Protestant at the stake for in the 1600s, they're now doing themselves. So in many ways, we've won a lot of the battles. Now, the Catholic Church still has a lot of their heretical doctrines that we can't accept, but they have really cleaned up the act. Their popes are not doing a lot of the scandals they used to do. They're not hawking indulgences as grotesquely as was done. I would say in many cases you've even got Catholics who seem to have an evangelical faith because they've been so exposed to the Protestants, they're reading the Bibles. So, yes, to a large extent, if the reformers were to come today, they would be quite impressed with how much impact they've actually had, even amongst the Catholics. The Reformation forced the Catholics to sort out a lot of things. The Counter-Reformation in some ways was bad, but in many ways the Counter-Reformation cleaned up a lot of the bad behavior and the corruption within the Catholic Church too. And in Second Vatican Council, they basically ran up the white flag. No longer are we heretics, now we Protestants are called separated brethren. And no longer are Catholics forbidden to read the Bible, but encouraged to read the Bible. So, yeah, big leaps have been made. So, yes, to a large extent, we need to recognize a lot of the battles were won. A lot of what the reformers fought for have been achieved. It's our churches that need reformation right now. Many Protestant churches are worse than some Catholic churches, because you won't find many Catholic churches that would deny the Trinity or deny any of the tenets of the Apostles' Creed, but you find a lot of Protestant churches that don't even seem to hold to anything. Well, they're not real Protestant churches, of course, but when you think that even in South Africa, some of the Dutch Reformed Church can question if hell exists, if Satan is real, and whether homosexual perversion can be called a marriage, that's high apostasy.
Actually, in Europe, you have got quite a few conversions from Protestantism to Catholicism, simply because the Catholics stick to the Ten Commandments, you know, and the general Christian ethics.
Yes, when you find so-called Protestant churches that have abandoned the Apostles' Creed and Ten Commandments, that's very basic. So you can see even the temptation right now, and we shouldn't judge those people too harshly, because they are responding to extreme apostasy. Yeah. I think the World Council of Churches and a lot of the so-called Reformed churches would be severely chastised and tongue-lashed, I'm sure, by any reformer today. Just think what goes on in these church councils. It's a scandal. At the back of the Great Century Reformation, we've got a few things that do help. The one thing was a chronology of the Reformation. I went year by year, starting in the pre-reformers, but going through and then getting more intense when it gets to the 1600s, what happened year by year. So that helps to just see it totally chronologically, just events. But then, for those people who want to follow the calendar, like what happened on this date, to look at it, and it's got just the dates of the year going, you know, so that, okay, 7th of October, Battle of Lepanto, it's on 10th of October. So you've got the different events on what happened on that day. It's got the year as well, but of course the years all leap backwards and forwards. But just to go through a calendar, so you've got both a calendar of the Reformation and a chronology of the Reformation, which help. But then there's other things that could help where people get a bit, I don't know, what's going on. So we've got the people of the Reformation, the pre-reformers, the reformers, their dates, and a quick summary of what they were and which was the country. 16. And then we've got the enemies of the Reformation and the allies of the Reformation. And it's amazing how many popes that Martin Luther survived. And these popes are excommunicating them and dying like flies. Luther survived more than six popes. And at one point somebody said, which pope gave you the most trouble? And he said, Pope Self. He said, Pope Self, who is he? He said, well, the Pope of the South. He said, the pope that sits on the throne in my heart, he says, he's given me more trouble than all the other popes. He's saying, as you know, the real enemy is us, that's a healthy thing. But so basically, a lot of these indexes here are just trying to help one make sense of the different chapters. So, if you think of each chapter and each reformer, is a building block. But then you sort of need still the foundations and the skeletons. And, to make sense of it all out of one book, that's how I try to put it all together. But I think, obviously, like anything, the more you know, the more you can understand it all, and suddenly something fits in. When you start putting a jigsaw puzzle together, it's frustrating. You get the corners, you get the edges, but the further it goes, after a while it gets easier, and then suddenly this is, you can see where the final pieces fit in. But at the beginning, it's a whole new world, and a lot of it is blank spaces, and all we're doing is filling in a corner here and there. So if you think of it like that, it's a rewarding study going into the Reformation, but the more I've gone to this museum or that site or studied this person or read this book, the more it's filled in blanks and given a bit more colour and depth and perspective. So that's why I think going to the museums, and of course what I try to do here is show a lot of the pictures of the museums that we found and the sites so we can visualise and grasp it and put the stories together. But this here, I was encouraged by Bill Bathman to do a geostrategic survey of the Reformation, what happened politically at the same time that all these reformers were acting, to try and give the context to what they were doing. Because the reformers weren't sitting in a study thinking high thoughts. They were in the middle of a situation of countries and fighting and war and threats. And, you know, bear in mind, Luther wasn't just sitting in a tower. The Muslims were bashing at the doors of Vienna and Budapest. They were threatening the heartland of Europe. Europe was devastated by these attacks of these early communists, like the Anabaptists and others, who were tearing things down and burning castles. And it just was a violent, difficult time. And the Reformation took root in some of the worst circumstances imaginable. But also to think, Martin Luther's life is overlapping with the discoveries of Christopher Columbus and opening up of the New World. And you can just see how amazing this was, that as the Catholics look like they are becoming super powerful, they've got all the gold of the New World, and they've got all the control of the Americas, but they're not settling the North, which is, of course, colder climate, made more comfortable in a warmer climate. And God's preparing the Protestant peoples to take the North of America. And, at the time, who would have known that there would have even been Protestant countries to have taken those areas? They could not have predicted what God was going to do in the next centuries.
It was all your lectures over the years and so on. For us that have been here for longer, because some of these people haven't been here for that long, and all the presentations you've given before, that also makes it easier for us to understand how it all fits together.
Yes, I mean,
in the order and everything.
Well, we've dealt more with the 16th century than any other.
Yeah.
Good. Any other comments, questions?
I just think, you know, the Catholics, they have such a horrific past of that religion of the blood of Christians on their hands. It's actually unspeakable how many people have died at their hands. You know, believers and things like that, you know, just because the beast sleeps, you know, that she's not showing her teeth, I wouldn't trust her further than anything, you know. It's horrific what they've done, you know, in history. It's unspeakable. And we know persecution still in Catholic countries, very South America, and that where Protestants are often, you know, put under pressure and things like this by the Catholics. They're just not able to carry on like they were. I don't trust them further.
That's right. Well, Bill Bathman says that when he was in Spain in 1950s, he was smuggling Bibles into Spain, and that was illegal to smuggle Bibles into Spain. And Christians were getting murdered there. He said he saw a Catholic priest standing over a Protestant who was bleeding to death, sucking on a cigarette while the Protestant expired under his feet, and he used to stand there, not allowing anyone to help him. He had just been beaten up by Catholic parishioners. Spanish Protestant. And that's in the 50s. Yeah, there were things going on like this in South America and Colombia and so on. Going through speaks about that. So that's just in the lifetime of Bill Bathman, he's seen that kind of persecution.